Well, good to have all of you here tonight, and we will continue in John chapter 9. I'm seeking to finish the chapter tonight. We saw last time where Jesus and his disciples, after an attempt at stoning Jesus occurred in the temple, that Jesus went down into the vicinity of the Pool of Siloam, and as he did so, his disciples commented upon a man who had been born blind. And they were asking, who was responsible for this? Who sinned? Was it the man or was it his parents? And Jesus said, neither. The blindness was in order that the glory of God could be displayed through the Son. So Jesus proceeded to heal the man, but then told him to go to the Pool of Siloam and to wash after Jesus had applied mud to his eyes. The man went, he washed, he came back seeing, and then there was an argument among the people that had known him before. Was this the same man or was it someone different? And the man kept saying, I am. That is, I am the one. And they then, at the start of our passage, decided to bring him to the Pharisees in order to figure out what was going on. Now, one detail I have not yet mentioned is that it was a Sabbath on the day that Jesus did this healing. So let's break in at John chapter 9, verse 13. And I have provided my translation. Some of the people, some of the neighbors and others that had seen the man and knew that he was blind, brought him, the formerly blind one, to the Pharisees. Now, it was a Sabbath when Jesus made clay and opened his eyes. Let's see. I forgot that I had left this slide on. Let me go ahead and back up and do some background. Okay, so this is a timeline of Jesus' ministry, covering 3.5 years. The point that is highlighted in light blue is where we are looking. During the Feast of Tabernacles, or also known as Sukkot or Booths, September of the year 32, this is our general context. John chapters 7 through 10, verse 21, occur at Sukkot. But let's back up and let's look a little more closely at the timeline of this section, John 7, 1 through 10, 21. Approximately 6 days before the feast began, which would, if it is 6 days, be September the 4th, which would be a Thursday, John chapter 7, verses 1 through 9, Jesus' brothers, or his half-brothers, were attempting to urge him to go to the feast. One of the reasons that they were concerned was that Jesus had boycotted going to Jerusalem for ever since the previous Feast of Tabernacles. How is it that we know that Jesus had not gone to Jerusalem for the feast? Well, the first clue is rather straightforward in John chapter 7, verse 1. After these things, that is, after the events of John chapter 6, which verse 4 of chapter 6 tells us was around the time of Passover, Jesus did not want to walk in Judea because the Judeans sought to kill him. So he remained up north. He was in Galilee and elsewhere, but he remained away from Judea, away from where there were plots to kill him. We have further evidence that Jesus did not go down to Jerusalem. Besides the statement that he walked in Galilee rather than walking in Judea. When one looks at John 7:1, the question becomes, well, did it mean that immediately after the events of John 6 that Jesus refused to go down to Jerusalem? Well, we have further confirmation from Matthew chapter 17, in which Jesus ultimately paid the temple tax up in Capernaum. Temple tax collectors were going around the country, and they came upon Peter and asked him if his master paid the temple tax. Now, the only reason that they would come to collect the tax from someone is because that person had not paid it previously. Anytime one would go to Passover, that was when the current tax was due, and if a person went to any feast subsequent to that in order to participate in the feast, they would make themselves current on the tax. They knew that Jesus had not been there for the Passover, nor had he been there subsequently, and as a result, they thought that he was delinquent on his taxes. So, let's now specify the timeline of John 8:2 through 10:21. That is the longest day, the most detailed day that we have in Jesus' ministry. He was teaching in the temple in the morning, and I would say early morning because of the text indicating that it was around dawn. When it says in John 8:2, early in the morning, it's referring to the time around dawn. Jesus started teaching, and very soon after, Pharisees and scribes brought a woman caught in adultery and tried to trip Jesus up. After he embarrassed them and they went walking out, then we have a discussion that takes place in the temple, John 8:12 through 59. That section is, I would say, late morning, and it ends with some of the hecklers wanting to stone him, John 8:59. So at that point, he left the temple. This is when he encountered the man born blind. And so last week we considered verses 1 through 12. Tonight we're going to go through verse 41. Then later, after all the events, after he's healed the man, that is, sent the man to the Pool of Siloam, the man returned. There was a discussion by the neighbors. Then they brought him to the Pharisees, and the Pharisees interrogated him. The Pharisees kicked the man out. And then Jesus encountered him and had a further discussion with some Pharisees. Then in response to all of that, Jesus told the Good Shepherd passage, John 10:1 through 21. So that is a timeline of the most detailed day in Jesus' ministry. Notice at 8:59 there was an attempt to stone Jesus. That set up the reason that Jesus left the temple. That set up the encounter with the man born blind. Jesus then proceeded to send him off to be healed. Okay. We need to talk a little bit about the Pharisees that Jesus met. There were three distinct groups. Group one brought the adulterous woman. Group two were ones that were there presumably since the very beginning of Jesus' teaching at dawn. That is the group that tried to stone him, but then we have Jesus encountering some additional Pharisees in John chapter 9, verse 16 and verse 40. Jesus didn't meet them in 16, but that indicates that this is the group that was that included people who had been involved in the interrogation of the blind men that ultimately excommunicated him. Jesus met some of those people. Why is it that I say that it's three distinct groups, as we have on the left, rather than overlapping groups on the right? Well, specifically, I'm saying that group two does not overlap with groups one and three. It does seem that there is overlap between one and three. Why is this important? If group two wanted to stone him, I suspect that they would have said, well, he blasphemed, and they would proceed to try to stone him. It's a distinct group. Now, how is this possible? Well, first of all, when Jesus left the temple, we see in verse 59 of John chapter 8, he hid himself, and then he escaped, went down to the near the Pool of Siloam. This group doesn't even know that he's there. But furthermore, they probably would be reticent to go that far because it was a Sabbath. The eighth day of the Feast of Tabernacles was always a Sabbath, no matter what day of the week the eighth day happened to fall. Now, we have a very important question to ask. This will have significance later. When is it that this formerly blind man believed? Many people see him coming to faith as he's talking with the Pharisees. And they say, well, you know what? At first he answers questions such as, well, there was a charge that Jesus was a sinner. And he says, well, I don't know if he's a sinner. And he identifies Jesus as a prophet. And, you know, the question becomes, is that all that he thought Jesus was, or might he have thought that he was more than that? But let's ask a little bit from the background of this passage. So I know I'm reaching into what I'm going to be teaching, but that's all right. The interrogation ended up turning to the parents, and the reason for that is the Pharisees were told in verse 14, the Judean Pharisees, did not believe concerning him that he had been blind and received his sight until they called the parents of him who received his sight. What ended up happening was the parents did testify, this is our son, and he was born blind, he now sees. The parents' testimony stood up to the cross-examination by the Pharisees. So the Pharisees ended up concluding, well, yes, indeed, a miracle has happened. This man was blind, he was born blind, and he has now been healed. Okay, that's part of the background. But let's look a little further. In verse 19, the Judean Pharisees asked the parents, is this your son whom you say was born blind? Then how does he now see? His parents answered them and said, we know that this is our son and that he was born blind, but by what means he sees, we do not know. Or who opened his eyes, we do not know. He is of age, ask him, he will speak for himself. They threw him under the bus. His parents said these things, that is, they said, we don't know who did it, and we don't know how it happened, because they feared the Judeans, for the Judeans had already agreed that if anyone confessed that he was the Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. Therefore, his parents said, "He is of age, ask him." This tells us that the parents knew that Jesus claimed to be Messiah. He claimed to be the Christ. After all, there would not need to be a conference between leaders saying, well, if anyone confesses that Jesus is the Christ, if anyone confesses that he's the Messiah, we will excommunicate that person. That would not be a decision they would reach unless, first of all, Jesus were claiming that, and secondly, that there were people who were confessing that. The parents know this. What do you suppose that the son also knew this? I think so. And I would say that because he is quite bold and he is quite astute. All the way through this, he is tying the Pharisees in knots. They don't know what to do with him. They think that it will be a fairly simple thing to make this blind man seem foolish and then be able to excommunicate him without any problem whatsoever. But he ties him up in knots. He asks serious questions. If the parents knew that Jesus claimed to be Messiah, I would strenuously argue that so did the son. But let's ask a further question. If someone came up and they spit, and then they put clay from the spit and the clay on the ground onto your eyes, are you going to just say, oh, great, this is a great idea. I just love having sand in my eyes. And furthermore, if that man says, go and wash in the pool of Siloam, this man has a thriving business of collecting alms from people. Why would he leave his favorite spot where people are used to seeing him and will give him money? I would argue he went and he was willing to have Jesus smear the clay on his eyes because he expected that Jesus would heal him. But furthermore, let's look at how the man addressed Jesus. Look at John 9:35. Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and when he found him, he said to him, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" He answered and said, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" And Jesus said to him, "You have both seen him, and it is he who is talking with you." Then he said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. My sense is that this man is gradually revealing what he knows about Jesus. It is not his process of discovery. It is not that he becomes aware of what Jesus claims. If the man were not a believer before, he might say, well, okay, it's conceivable that he would say, okay, I'll check this out. But when he came back seeing, he knows what Jesus claimed. By that point, he's definitely already believed. The scenario that says he doesn't become a believer until the point that he's told about the Son of God doesn't really match the details of the text. Now, I know some of your Bibles say Son of Man. We'll talk about that when we get there, into John chapter 9, verse 35. But now let's go back to verse 13. An important question here is, Why did these neighbors and others that had seen that he had been, that he was blind and begged, why is it that they brought him to the Pharisees? I mean, what's the big deal? The man has been healed. Under most circumstances, you would say, well, they'd say, oh, well, you know, that's great. And they'd leave it there. What is this burning desire to get an answer from the Pharisees? Why is it that they need to do this? Well, let's back up a little bit in the context. We saw that the neighbors, verse 8, and those who had previously seen that he was blind said, is this not he who sat and begged? And some said, this is he. Others said, he is like him. I argued last week that it is very possible that some of the people were motivated by fear, saying, well, the Pharisees are going to put us out of the synagogue. After all, the parents know that. But furthermore, we saw in John chapters 7 and 8 that people were afraid of the Judeans and were fearful to speak up because the Judeans were very actively, the Judean leadership was very actively persecuting anyone who would confess Jesus as the Christ. So some may have said, well, I'm not going to stick my neck out. I'm not going to say what I really know. I'm going to say, well, he just looks like the man. But as I have reflected on this further, I would say that there probably are people who specifically want to deny that there was indeed a miracle. They would want for the Pharisees to establish that, no, there was some sort of sleight of hand going on here. Now, let's set this up. The top part of this assumes that the men were found by the Pharisees to actually have been healed. Well, the Pharisees would still excommunicate the men because what would he have done? He would have confessed Jesus as the Christ. So these neighbors and ones that knew that he was blind that were unfavorable towards the fact that a healing had happened, they're not just afraid, but they don't want one really to have happened. They would say, well, if he were healed, then the man will be excommunicated. Maybe we'll get a reward from the Pharisees for having confronted this crisis and let them know about this man. But secondly, they would say, well, that would give the Pharisees a reason to stone Jesus. That Jesus would be found to have done work on the Sabbath, and lo and behold, he could be stoned. Boy, I bet we'd get a big reward for that. Well, then on the other hand, if it turned out that everyone here was just lying and it was a big scam and the man wasn't healed, well, presumably the man would be excommunicated and they might receive a little reward. My suspicion is there might be a money trail here. That might be what the big reason was for bringing the man to the Pharisees. But let's see what happens. There is a discussion amongst the Pharisees. First of all, we find in let's start here with verse 13. Some brought him, the formerly blind one, to the Pharisees. Now it was Sabbath when Jesus made clay and opened his eyes. That's the reason that they're interested in bringing him to the Pharisees. There's a religious aspect of this, and maybe even a reward. So again, those Pharisees also were asking how he gained sight. So he told them, "He put clay on my eyes, I washed, and I see." Then we have a division. Division between two groups, like this great chasm here that happened in Alaska with an earthquake. So some of those Pharisees said, "This man is not from God because he doesn't keep the Sabbath." Other Pharisees were saying, "How can a sinful man do such signs?" So there was a division among them. The reasoning of the first group is, major premise, a God-sent one would keep the Sabbath. This man is not from God. Why? He doesn't keep the Sabbath. Therefore, he is not from God. They thought that that was a reasonable line of argumentation to say, Jesus is not really the Messiah. But the counter-argument that is given is also in the form of a syllogism by group two. No sinful man, that is, no ordinary man, can do such signs. And it would only be if God were to empower. Not even prophets had healed someone born blind. We find later in the passage that the blind man, the formerly blind man, points out in verse 32, "Since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind." Jesus has already healed people that were blind, but they had become blind. They were not ones that were born blind. So they say, this has to be someone above the class of some sinful person that flagrantly violates God's rules. You know, if what he did were deemed by God to be a terrible violation of the Sabbath, such a sinner obviously would not be empowered by God to do such signs. Therefore, Jesus is not a sinful or ordinary man. The claim that he is the Christ would then necessarily be a legitimate claim. So each of these groups has a starting point and they have a conclusion. Interestingly, exactly the same syllogistic argument is going to continue. It's not going to be resolved here, but it's going to continue all the way through the passage. So now the question comes to the formerly blind man. The Pharisees ask him, what he said about Jesus. Notice verse 17. The Pharisees said to the blind man again, "What do you say about him because he opened your eyes?" So he said, "He is a prophet." I think that's a pretty safe statement. Deuteronomy chapter 18 makes it clear that prophets always came with verification. One of the lines of verification was that if a prophet said something, it had to come true. They could not have 99% of what they said be true. 100% had to be true. But also, it was not uncommon in the Old Testament for prophets to do signs. And Jesus fully meets the qualification of a prophet. In fact, in Acts chapter 3, Peter says that Jesus is the prophet that Moses predicted, the prophet like Moses, the greater than Moses prophet like Moses. So this is a safe, this is a true statement. The man has not, I believe, revealed all that he knows about Jesus. He has made a safe statement, but he knows that even this will have consequences. If he were to come out directly and say he is the messianic prophet, he would have instantly incurred even greater ire from the Pharisees in this synagogue. Well, we are told by John in verse 18 that the and I would add the word some, as I do in my translation, notice it is in italics, therefore some Judean leaders did not believe about him that he was blind and gained sight, until they summoned the parents of him, the one who had gained sight. It's indicating there were ones that definitely disbelieved the testimony of this man. They thought some sort of sleight of hand has occurred, and they did not believe it, did not believe that there had been a healing. So, of necessity, they say, well, the parents would know, and if the parents are lying, we are good enough interrogators, we will be able to uncover their inconsistencies. In all probability, they separated them and asked each of the three of them questions to see if they could find any inconsistencies. But notice what it says in the last part of verse 18. Until they summoned the parents of him. They did not believe that he was blind and gained sight until they summoned the parents. This is telling us that the parents withstood the interrogation. Their testimony did not fall apart. Now, we know that they didn't tell the whole truth. They told the truth, but they did not tell the whole truth. They didn't say, we know who it was that healed our son. Nor did they say, we know how he healed our son. But they did say, this is our son. He was born blind. Now he sees. And that testimony stood up. And this passage is indicating all of the Pharisees came to conclude, well, yes, some sort of a miracle has happened. Now, from the synoptics, we find places where the Pharisees accused of Jesus of having done signs because of being demon-possessed. John chapter 8, they've already accused Jesus of being demon-possessed. Presumably, that would be how they would explain the miracle happening and say, well, a sinful man controlled by Satan, okay, a satanic counterfeit. But it is important to know they have concluded that, yes, indeed, a miracle has occurred. So now we get some of the details of the questioning of the parents. And they ask, is this your son? Was he born blind? How now does he see? So in verse 19, then they questioned them, saying, is this your son, whom you say was born blind? So now how does he see? For those of you who haven't been part of this study, I'll explain why the dots occur in verse 19. They indicate that the word your is plural, or the word you. And so this is addressed to the parents, a plural group. If you is singular, then it will not have such a dot accompanying it. So they're looking at the basic facts that had been in dispute, but as they continue to interrogate the parents, they conclude, well, no, the parents are telling truth. A healing has occurred. Verse 21, though, now the parents speak, but they throw their son under the bus. They say, but how he now sees, we do not know. That's a lie. Nor do we know who opened his eyes. Another lie. He is of age, ask him. He will speak for himself. Okay, we don't want to get kicked out of the synagogue, but if you want to kick our son out, be our guest. You know, essentially they're saying here to their son, sorry, son, just can't risk this. We love you with our whole heart. Yeah. They just threw him under the bus when they said, we do not know. They are looking out for themselves. I'm sure that these people have concluded, well, Jesus must be the Messiah. After all, nobody else has ever healed someone who was born blind. But they're fearful to confess it. They're not like their son. Their son may have been born blind, and people may have looked down upon him, but he's a courageous man, and he stands up for what he believes. Yeah, he does not back down. He's an utter contrast to his parents. Well, now it returns to the son. Okay, we know that you were healed. And so now the question is, let's make sure he knows he's under oath. Let's make sure that he knows that there can be consequences for his words. So when they say, give glory to God, in verse 24, they're saying, you're under oath. You know, we've seen the parents back away because the parents got scared, but now they're trying to scare the son and say, yeah, we're putting you under oath. There will be consequences here. Watch your words carefully. So after the parents have told half-truths based upon knowing that if they had confessed him as the Christ, they would have been outcast. They would have been excommunicated. They don't want that to happen. They demurred on giving a truthful answer on that question. But now the interrogation turns to the son. Verse 24, so a second time those Judean leaders summoned the man who had been blind and told him, give glory to God. We know that this man is a sinner. Please note, they have summoned him again. This tells us that he was not in the presence of his parents when they testified. And presumably his parents were separated as well from each other. That's standard procedure in order to figure out whether there has been a contrived story, whether there has been collusion, or whether truth has actually been told. Of course, we've seen that they have concluded, well, yes, indeed, the man was healed. But now we get the courageous answer from the man. He says, I am not a theological expert. So whether he's a sinner, I do not know. I don't know all the intricacies of whether what he did in healing me on a Sabbath is a sinful action. That's above my pay grade. I'm not a theologian. I don't have a big library. So I can't answer that question. That's out of my area of expertise. I would be giving hearsay. I would be giving an opinion. I'm not a good witness on that. I don't know that. Is he saying, well, it's quite conceivable in my mind that Jesus is a sinner? I don't think so, because of what he says very soon. We'll get to that. But what he does say is, one thing I know, though I was blind, now I see. I know that a miracle has happened. And you do too now. So how do you answer that, Pharisees? So once again, they approach him by asking, well, how did he heal you? What did he do? Why is it that they keep repeating? One of the words that you might notice showing up here is again, and again, and again. The whole reason for that in an interrogation is to see whether there's embellishment, whether the person is a true witness, or whether they have started adding some details and forgetting what they've added here and there, and therefore having inconsistencies that develop. But there is never any embellishment at all by this man. He never claims credit for anything. It's just, he came, he made mud, he told me to go wash, I washed, I see. He didn't add anything to it, he's just telling the facts, nothing but the facts, and that's all he says. But their question is, how? Once again, how did it happen? What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? And he answered them, you don't see and you don't listen. Who's the blind one now? He answered them, I already told you, but you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? You do not wish to become his disciples, do you? Don't you get it? Don't you see? You didn't listen and you don't see. You're blind. I used to be blind. You are blind. And yeah, he's telling it to them as it is. And he's saying, you don't want to become his disciples, do you? I'm sure that you don't want to become his disciple. I'm sure that's not why you're asking this. But you know, I've told you this. I've given you exactly the same story every time I tell you. How do you explain that I see? So they reviled him. They called him some names that the Bible chose not to reveal to us, saying, you are a disciple of that one, but we are Moses' disciples. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but this one, we don't know where he's from. They ran out of arguments, and they strike. It's personal attack, it's character assassination, because they don't have any good response to what the man has said. Remember I said that way back in the beginning, the question was, wow, this man is breaking the Sabbath, so this can't be from God. And then the answer to that was, well, someone who is a rebel against God isn't going to be able to do this. He's sent from God. This miracle proves it. And that's exactly the same place that this is at now. The man is maintaining, I have been healed. And the Pharisees are stuck upon what happened on the Sabbath, so it has to be wrong. But they have no further arguments, so all they can do is revile him. But you know, they've got blinders on their eyes. And the man points that out. He says, you of all people ought to know where he's from. Because no one has ever done anything like this. There's never been a healing of someone born blind. You got blinders on. You can't see. You can't see what's right in front of you. So in verse 30, the man told him in reply, "For in this something is something astounding. You do not know where he is from, yet he opened my eyes." Now we know that God does not listen to sinners. But if one is God-fearing and does his will, he listens to him. It has never been heard of anyone opening the eyes of anyone born blind, has it? Unless this man were from God, he could not do anything. You know, when you notice here, he's given the answer to the question of, is he a sinner? Yeah, I mean, that's the charge that was given back in verse 24. And he said, I'm not a theological expert. I can't really address that. But here he does. My sense is he's gradually revealing what he knows about Jesus. It's not that he's gradually discovering more. It's that he's gradually revealing his knowledge. He's got them on the run. I mean, for them not to be able to explain Jesus' origins, I mean, obviously they want to claim that he was born in Nazareth. They want to claim that he's illegitimate. They don't deny that he's from the tribe of Judah. They don't deny that he's of the lineage of David. But they want to deny his legitimacy by birth and his legitimacy as Messiah. But he says, "Yeah, isn't it your responsibility to know anything about someone claiming to be Messiah? And especially the fact that he has done something that nobody has ever done." He's got them on the run. And once again, we have a character assassination. But before we get there, when he said that God does not hear the prayers of a sinner, it's often been stated, God does not hear the prayers of unbelievers. I think it's important for us to analyze what's going on here. There's a figure of speech called a metonymy of the cause for the effect. And we can ask a facetious question. Is this man saying that God needs a hearing aid? Is he saying God is incapable of discerning that a sinful person, an unbeliever, has asked a question? Clearly the man is not saying that. What's in mind? Hearing is used figuratively to stand for answering. God clearly hears all prayers. But the man is not talking about, if Jesus were a sinner, God wouldn't have heard his prayer. Is what he means is, God would not hear it, that is, God would not answer it. He's saying that God answers prayers of righteous people. That's clearly true. Let me clarify a little bit, though, how to handle it on the negative. Now, this is not to scale. That is, the vertical scale is not intended to be, it's not significant. I've just put lines here, top one being 100%, second one being a lower percent, next one being a lower percent, and the bottom one being 0%. 100% of Jesus' prayers are according to the Father's will. Therefore, they are all heard and they are all answered, 100% of them. You may remember that in John chapter 11, Martha said to Jesus, "Whatever you ask of God, God will give to you." Right? 100% of Jesus' prayers are according to his will, and they are all answered. Within John's writings, John points out that there are promises that anything that we ask in his name, and it was addressed specifically to the 11, we'll talk more about that when we get to those passages, but that which is prayed in his name is speaking about that which is prayed according to the Father's will. A certain percentage of prayers that believers have is according to his will. Now, if I pray to win some big lottery, God's not going to answer that. Well, first of all, of course, I've never bought a lottery ticket anyway. Going to be kind of hard to win a lottery that I haven't purchased a ticket, but God does not answer prayers that are not according to his will. I would imagine it's a higher percentage than 0% of unbelievers' prayers are according to the Father's will. And it seems that when we look at Cornelius in the book of Acts, it seems that he wanted to know about the true God, and God revealed himself to Cornelius and told him that he was to go and seek out a man named Peter who will tell him how he might be saved. But the prayer that he had was a prayer that was according to God's will. But we do know that 0% of Satan's prayers are according to the Father's will, and therefore 0% of them are answered. And you might say, well, sometimes Satan speaks truth. Well, he speaks truths and half-truths in order to get something that he wants that is not according to God's will. And so what he would be seeking as he would, shall we say, hypothetically pray, 0% of those would be according to the Father's will. Therefore, 0% of them would be answered. I think that this is how we should understand what the man is saying. But furthermore, we should also understand, he's already said, I'm not a theologian. This is how this man has constructed it as he makes an argument, but I would not say that his words are ones that are necessarily binding upon God. So let's leave it at that. But what is it that he says here? What is his argument that he makes for saying that these Pharisees ought to take seriously that Jesus has done a never-before-done miracle? He says, no one has ever healed someone born blind. That is just never, ever, ever happened. Verse 32. It has never been heard of anyone opening the eyes of anyone born blind, has it? And the expected answer is no. He's saying, you need to take him seriously. They revile him once again. Verse 34. Let's see, before they revile him, we have one further slide here. If he were not from God, he could do nothing. He's giving an argument that Jesus has demonstrated that he is indeed sent from God. I would argue he already has understood that Jesus is the Messiah. I believe that for sure that has happened by the time he was healed. It very likely had occurred before he was healed. He recognizes that Jesus is from God. He recognizes Jesus as Messiah. Their response to him is to say, "You were born entirely in sin. You can't teach us anything." So verse 34, in reply, they told him, "You were born altogether in sins, yet are you teaching us?" And they cast him out of the synagogue. They're saying, "You're trying to teach us, but we're not going to learn anything from you. We regard you as an utter sinner." Notice they have made exactly the same argument that Jesus' disciples did at the beginning of the chapter, saying, "Whose sin caused this man's blindness? The man or his parents?" Jesus said, "Neither." But these things have happened so that the Son of God should be glorified. Although Jesus has not given this answer to the Pharisees, that is the answer that is appropriate in response to the Pharisees. They were utterly wrong, and they ought to have looked in the mirror. And they ought to be saying to the man, "Well, you have become entirely sighted, but we won't learn from you." The idea of teaching is causative. That is, in fact, in Hebrew, the word to teach literally means to cause someone to learn. And because it's the hyphal stem of the verb lamad. Lamad means to learn. The hyphal stem of that is translated to teach, but it is causative, and it literally means to cause someone to learn. When they say, you're attempting to teach us, teaching can only happen if learning occurs. And they're saying, "We refuse to learn from you. We voluntarily blind ourselves. You see, we don't." Quite an admission. So what happens? They call the bouncers and they cast him out. Jesus then encounters the men. Verse 35. In verse 35, Jesus heard that those Judean leaders had cast him out of the synagogue. And upon finding him, he asked him, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" He said in reply, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" Now, I know some of your Bibles say Son of Man. Now, Son of Man is a term of deity, going back to Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 and 14. It is a term of deity, but the proper text reads, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" He said in reply, "And who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" This has often been misinterpreted as this man has not yet believed in Jesus as the Messiah. But see, I've got slides out of order here, but we asked earlier, when did the man believe? For sure, by the time the man has returned from the Pool of Siloam, able to see. But I would argue, in interpreting this passage, that what we're looking at is blue plus yellow equals green. The man starts out with old content. He knew that Jesus, he knew that the man who healed him was named Jesus. He knew that he was Lord. Now Jesus gives him some new content. "Do you believe in the Son of God?" And the man says, "Okay, I don't know quite how to connect that up here. I don't know what to do with that information. So you're going to have to tell me who he is so that I can believe in him. And what Jesus does is to identify himself as God's Son. He says in verse 37, "You have both seen him, and he is the one who is speaking with you." So the man said, "I believe, Lord," and he worshiped him. Jesus has given him new content. This is not the point that the man has come to believe in Jesus as Messiah, but it is the point that he knows that in addition to the claim that he is the Son, that he is Messiah, which, remember, the Judeans had already conspired that if anyone confessed Jesus as Christ or as Messiah, they would excommunicate that person. Now Jesus informs him, "I am not only Messiah, but I am the Son of God." Notice how that leads into the purpose statement of John. John's objective for his unbelieving readers who do not know that Jesus is Messiah and who do not know that Jesus is God's Son is that they would know both of those truths. But this man has already believed in Jesus as Messiah. Jesus is informing him of an additional identification. He is also the Son of God. Now, this man has confessed Jesus at a cost. He has been excommunicated. He has been kicked out of the synagogue. He has paid a cost for this. And notice, that happened as he confessed Jesus as the Christ before he knew that he was Son of God. I would argue this whole context is pointing out this man already was a believer, and he was a believer who was already paying the price before he knew this additional truth about Jesus, that Jesus is the Son of God, in addition to being Messiah and Lord. And so, let's see, in this passage, Jesus says then in verse 39, "For judgment I came into this world, so that those seeing should not seeing should see, and those seeing should become blind." And what this prompts is some Pharisees to ask, "Are we blind also?" Yes, they are as blind as bats, but they do have some limited perception, and for that they will be accountable. So in verse 40, "And some of the Pharisees who were with him heard these things and said to him, 'We are not blind also, are we?' And they're expecting that he's going to say, 'No, you're not, you're just fine.' But Jesus told them, 'If you were blind, you would not have sin.'" You would not have culpability at this particular point. He's not saying you wouldn't be sinful people, but you would not have culpability on this issue here. But now you say, "We see," so your sin remains. Now, why is it that Jesus is asserting that they do have some limited sight? You know, he's accepting their own verdict that they say, "We see," so therefore he says, "Well, yes, indeed, that's true. You do have some limited sight." It's like Lady Justice lifting the veil. Why does he say this? Well, things are not always what they seem. Here you see a man that's carrying groceries, carrying produce from his garden, but the shadow makes it look like he's carrying a baby. things are not always what they seem. They are, in one sense, as blind as bats. They cannot see. They are blind, unlike this man who was born blind that now sees both physically and spiritually. They do not understand spiritual things, but they have enough sight to have culpability. And let's prove it. Remember, we are told earlier in the passage, back in verse 18, that the Judeans did not believe that this man was born blind until they interrogated the parents. Now, we found that the parents told their half-truth because they knew that the Judeans had already agreed to cast out any who confessed him as the Christ. Okay, they came to believe that, well, yes, indeed, this man was born blind, and he has indeed been healed. And, you know, everything that this man is saying is true, but we're going to kick him out anyway. They're kicking the man out for telling the truth. Let's see how that works. They started out not believing that the man was born blind, but they now believe that he had been born blind. They knew that he could now see. They asked him how it was that he came to see. He truthfully told them, and they cast him out. This man is punished for speaking truth. Fascinating passage. Just absolutely fascinating. Jesus here demonstrates, once again, with a sign that he is exactly who he claims to be. He is the life-giving Messiah, the Son of God. Those who believe in him for it are guaranteed everlasting life that can never be lost. We have a passage here of people blinded to truth. And we also have a visual picture of someone that was born blind, and through hearing about Jesus, hearing that he claimed to be Messiah, when Jesus came and proceeded to put clay on his eyes, told him to go to the Pool of Siloam and wash, the man went away believing. He went away as a blind man with spiritual sight, and he came back as a sighted man with spiritual sight. The Pharisees were ones who had physical sight, but they refused to see what was right in front of them, and they remained blind. They remained culpable. Questions?
I have a question.
Yes, Catherine.
I just want to make sure I understood you. So when we're talking about the phrase Son of God there in verse 35, that is the correct, you would go with that translation versus the Son of Man. And then you're saying that this is additional information, that the blind man was already a believer, but that this is new revelation that he is receiving. But when you go to the purpose statement of John 20, for the unbelieving readers, was that necessary content then for them to understand? And then also, what are the implications of that phrase, Son of God? I think you said that this is an expression of his deity. So could you further elaborate on that?
Well, okay. Let's first of all go back to thinking about the Samaritan woman. Does Son of God ever come up in that passage? No. What I would say is that Son of God and Messiah are seen as appositional terms. One of the requirements for the Messiah is that he be God, but he would be the divine Davidic king. That's requirement for Messiah, but that's what he is also as God's son. That God's son is not, the two are appositional terms. So the truth was understood back in John 4 without the use of Son of God, and I would argue that the truth was understood by this man before he understood a term that's in apposition to it, and the purpose statement sets forth things that are in apposition to one another. So it's not that it is a new and distinct truth, it is that it is a restatement of the same truth.
Okay.
Okay, I was asked the question, what is apposition? Okay, apposition is, if I were to say, my brother Joe. Well, Joe is my brother. And so when I use terms that are equivalents in a construction like that, normally set off with commas, that is called apposition. That's not the only way that apposition happens, but that's the most common form of apposition.
And then just to further piggyback on that, Son of God, the expression, I mean, just in my experience with talking to people, it's just always synonymous to his deity. And so just going kind of circling back to what you just said, you would say, I mean, did this blind man realize that when the Lord said the Son of God, that meant Jesus in the flesh? God, or God in the flesh, you know, the hypostatic union. Did he understand that by that expression, or in that setting, would that have been a reference to the fact that he's going to be king?
Yeah, his understanding of it would not have all the implications. What is necessary for a person is to understand that Jesus is capable of fulfilling his promises. That's fundamentally what is in view, that I reject any form of understanding of the message as a grocery list.
Right.
The fundamental issue is believing Jesus' promise of everlasting life, which he is capable of fulfilling because of who he is. And that's, so it's, and I wrote an article in Grace and Focus back in 2008 entitled "Who Can Give Eternal or Who Can Guarantee Eternal Life?" That addresses pertinent issues. And what I would say is that as we back up to the prologue of John, the argument that is set forth goes beyond the idea that Son of God is a term that is exactly equivalent to King of Israel, because he is the Messianic King, he is the promised King. Kings of Judah were referred to as Son of God, but that was in anticipation of the Messianic Son of God who would fulfill the term in all of its senses. But the fundamental idea in the purpose statement is it resides in the fact that he is the Messiah, the Son of the life-giving Messianic Son of God.
Mm-hmm.